Chapter 1. The Picture in the Bedroom. There was a boy called Eustace Clarence Scrub, and he almost deserved it. His parents called him Eustace Clarence, and masters called him Scrub. I can't tell you how his friends spoke to him, for he had none. He didn't call his father and mother father and mother, but Harold and Alberta. They were very up-to-date and advanced people. They were vegetarians, non-smokers, and teetotalers, and wore a special kind of underclothes. In their house there was very little furniture, and very few clothes on beds, and the windows were always open. Eustace Clarence liked animals, especially beetles, if they were dead and pinned on a card. He liked books, if they were books of information, and had pictures of grain elevators, or of fat foreign children doing exercises in model schools. Eustace Clarence disliked his cousins, the four Pevenses, Peter, Susan, Edmund, and Lucy. But he was quite glad when he heard that Edmund and Lucy were coming to stay, for deep down inside him he liked bossing and bullying. And though he was a puny little person who couldn't have stood up even to Lucy, let alone Edmund, in a fight, he knew that there are dozens of ways to give people a bad time if you are in your own home and they are only visitors. Edmund and Lucy did not at all want to come and stay with Uncle Harold and Aunt Alberta, but it really couldn't be helped. Father had got a job lecturing in America for 16 weeks that summer, and Mother was to go with him, because she hadn't had a real holiday for 10 years. Peter was working very hard for an exam, and he was to spend the holidays being coached by old Professor Kirk, in whose house these four children had had wonderful adventures long ago in the war years. If he had still been in that house, he would have had them all to stay. But he had somehow become poor since the old days, and was living in a small cottage with only one bedroom to spare. It would have cost too much money to take the other three all to America, and so only Susan had gone. Grown-ups thought her the pretty one of the family, and she was no good at schoolwork, though otherwise very old for her age. And Mother said she would get far more out of a trip to America than the youngsters. Edmund and Lucy tried not to grudge Susan her luck, but it was dreadful having to spend the summer holidays at their aunt's. "But it's far worse for me," said Edmund, "because at least you'll have a room of your own, and I shall have to share a bedroom with that record stinker Eustace." The story begins on an afternoon when Edmund and Lucy were stealing a few precious minutes alone together. And, of course, they were talking about Narnia, which was the name of their own private and secret country. Most of us, I suppose, have a secret country, but for most of us it is only an imaginary country. Edmund and Lucy were luckier than other people in that respect. Their secret country was real. They had already visited it twice, not in a game or a dream, but in reality. They had got there, of course, by magic, which is the only way of getting to Narnia, and a promise, or very nearly a promise, had been made them in Narnia itself that they would some day get back. You may imagine that they talked about it a good deal, when they got the chance. They were in Lucy's room, sitting on the edge of her bed and looking at a picture on the opposite wall. It was the only picture in the house that they liked. Aunt Alberta didn't like it at all. That was why it was put away in a little back room upstairs. But she couldn't get rid of it, because it had been a wedding present from someone she did not want to offend. It was a picture of a ship sailing straight towards you. Her prow was gilded and shaped like the head of a dragon with a wide open mouth. She had only one mast and one large square sail, which was a rich purple. The sides of the ship, what you could see of them where the gilded wings of the dragon ended, were green. She had just run up to the top of one glorious blue wave, and the nearer slope of that wave came down towards you, with streaks and bubbles on it. She was obviously running fast before a gay wind, listing over a little on her port side. By the way, if you are going to read this story at all, and if you don't know already, you had better get it into your head that the left of the ship, when you are looking ahead, is port, and the right is starboard. All the sunlight fell on her from that side, and the water on that side was full of greens and purples. On the other, it was darker blue from the shadow of the ship. "The question is," said Edmund, "whether it doesn't make things worse looking at a Narnian ship when you can't get there." "Even looking is better than nothing," said Lucy. "And she is such a bloody Narnian ship."
"Still playing your old game," said Eustace Clarence, who had been listening outside the door, and now came grinning into the room. Last year, when he had been staying with the Pevenses, he had managed to hear them all talking of Narnia, and he loved teasing them about it. He thought, of course, that they were making it all up, and as he was far too stupid to make anything up himself, he did not approve of that.
"You're not wanted here," said Edmund curtly.
"I'm trying to think of a limerick," said Eustace. "Something like this. Some kids who played games about Narnia got gradually balmier and balmier."
"Well, Narnia and balmier don't rhyme, to begin with," said Lucy.
"It's an assonance," said Eustace.
"Don't ask him what an assy thingamy is," said Edmund. "He's only longing to be asked. Say nothing, and perhaps he'll go away."
Most boys, on meeting a reception like this, would either have cleared out or flared up. Eustace did neither. He just hung about, grinning, and presently began talking again.
"Do you like that picture?"
he asked.
"For heaven's sake, don't let him get started about art and all that," said Edmund hurriedly.
But Lucy, who was very truthful, had already said,
"Yes, I do. I like it very much."
"It's a rotten picture," said Eustace.
"You won't see it if you step outside," said Edmund.
"Why do you like it?"
said Eustace to Lucy.
"Well, for one thing," said Lucy, "I like it because the ship looks as if it were really moving, and the water looks as if it were really wet, and the waves look as if they were really going up and down."
Of course, Eustace knew lots of answers to this, but he didn't say anything. The reason was that at that very moment he looked at the waves and saw that they did look very much indeed as if they were going up and down. He had only once been in a ship, and then only as far as the Isle of Wight, and had been horribly seasick. The look of the waves in the picture made him feel sick again. He turned rather green and tried another look, and then all three children were staring with open mouths. What they were seeing may be hard to believe when you read it in print, but it was almost as hard to believe when you saw it happening. The things in the picture were moving. It didn't look at all like a cinema, either. The colours were too real and clean and out of doors for that. Down went the prow of the ship into the wave, and up went a great shock of spray. And then up went the wave behind her, and her stern and her deck became visible for the first time, and then disappeared as the next wave came to meet her and her bows went up again. At the same moment, an exercise book which had been lying beside Edmund on the bed flapped, rose, and sailed through the air to the wall behind him, and Lucy felt all her hair whipping round her face, as it does on a windy day. And this was a windy day. But the wind was blowing out of the picture towards them. And suddenly, with the wind, came the noises, the swishing of waves, and the slap of water against the ship's sides, and the creaking and the overall high, steady roar of air and water. But it was the smell, the wild, briny smell, which really convinced Lucy that she was not dreaming.
"Stop it!"
came Eustace's voice, squeaky with fright and bad temper.
"It's some silly trick you two are playing. Stop it! I'll tell Alberta! Ow!"
The other two were much more accustomed to adventures, but just exactly as Eustace Clarence said, "Ow!" they both said, "Ow!" too. The reason was that a great cold salt splash had broken right out of the frame, and they were breathless from the smack of it.
besides being wet through.
"I'll smash the rotten thing!" cried Eustace.
And then several things happened at the same time. Eustace rushed towards the picture. Edmund, who knew something about magic, sprang after him, warning him to look out and not to be a fool. Lucy grabbed at him from the other side and was dragged forward, and by this time either they had grown much smaller or the picture had grown bigger. Eustace jumped to try to pull it off the wall and found himself standing on the frame. In front of him was not glass, but real sea, and the wind and waves rushing up to the frame as they might to a rock. He lost his head and clutched at the other two who had jumped up beside him. There was a second of struggling and shouting, and just as they thought they had got their balance, a great blue roller surged up round them, swept them off their feet, and drew them down into the sea. Eustace's despairing cry suddenly ended as the water got into his mouth. Lucy thanked her stars that she'd worked hard at her swimming in the summer term. It is true that she would have gone on much better if she had used a slower stroke, and also that the water felt a great deal colder than it had looked while it was only a picture. Still, she kept her head and kicked her shoes off, as everyone ought to do who falls into deep water in their clothes. She even kept her mouth shut and her eyes open. They were still quite near the ship. She saw its green side towering high above them, and people looking at her from the deck. Then, as one might have expected, Eustace clutched at her in a panic, and down they both went. When they came up again, she saw a white figure diving off the ship's side. Edmund was close beside her now, treading water, and had caught the arms of the howling Eustace. Then someone else, whose face was vaguely familiar, slipped an arm under her from the other side. There was a lot of shouting going on from the ship, heads crowding together above the bulwarks, ropes being thrown. Edmund and the stranger were fastening ropes round her. After that followed what seemed a very long delay, during which her face got blue and her teeth began chattering. In reality, the delay was not very long. They were waiting till the moment when she could be got on board ship without being dashed against its side. Even with all their best endeavours, she had a bruised knee when she finally stood, dripping and shivering, on the deck. After her, Edmund was heaved up, and then the miserable Eustace. Last of all came the stranger, a golden-headed boy some years older than herself.
"Caspian!"
gasped Lucy as soon as she had breath enough. For Caspian it was. Caspian, the boy king of Narnia, whom they had helped to set on the throne during their last visit. Immediately Edmund recognised him too. All three shook hands and clapped one another on the back with great delight. "But who is your friend?" said Caspian almost at once, turning to Eustace with his cheerful smile. But Eustace was crying much harder than any boy of his age had a right to cry, when nothing worse than a wetting had happened to him, and would only yell out,
"Let me go! Let me go! I don't like it!"
"Let you go?" said Caspian.
"But where?"
Eustace rushed to the ship's side, as if he expected to see the picture frame hanging above the sea, and perhaps a glimpse of Lucy's bedroom. What he saw was blue waves flecked with foam, and paler blue sky, both spreading without a break to the horizon. Perhaps we can hardly blame him if his heart sank. He was promptly sick.
"Hey, Reinulf," said Caspian to one of the sailors, "bring spiced wine for their majesties. You'll need something to warm you after that dip."
He called Edmund and Lucy their majesties because they and Peter and Susan had all been kings and queens of Narnia long before his time. Narnia time flows differently from ours. If you spent 100 years in Narnia, you would still come back to our world at the very same hour of the very same day on which you left. And then, if you went back to Narnia after spending a week here, you might find that 1,000 Narnian years had passed. Or only a day. Or no time at all. you never know till you get there.
Consequently, when the Pevensey children had returned to Narnia last time for their second visit, it was, for the Narnians, as if King Arthur came back to Britain, as some people say he will, and I say the sooner the better. Reinulf returned with the spiced wine, steaming in a flagon, and four silver cups. It was just what one wanted, and as Lucy and Edmund sipped it, they could feel the warmth going right down to their toes. But Eustace made faces and spluttered and spat it out and was sick again and began to cry again and asked if they hadn't any plum trees vitamized nerve food and could it be made with distilled water, and anyway, he insisted on being put ashore at the next station. "This is a merry shipmate you've brought us, brother," whispered Caspian to Edmund with a chuckle. But before he could say anything more, Eustace burst out again.
"Oh, ear! What on earth that? Take it away! The horrid thing!"
He really had some excuse this time for feeling a little surprised. Something very curious indeed had come out of the cabin in the poop and was slowly approaching them. You might call it, and indeed it was, a mouse. But then it was a mouse on its hind legs and stood about 2 feet high. A thin band of gold passed round its head, under one ear and over the other, and in this was stuck a long crimson feather. As the mouse's fur was very dark, almost black, the effect was bold and striking. Its left paw rested on the hilt of a sword, very nearly as long as its tail. Its balance, as it paced gravely along the swaying deck, was perfect, and its manners courtly. Lucy and Edmund recognized it at once. Reepicheep, the most valiant of all the talking beasts of Narnia, and the chief mouse. He had won undying glory in the second battle of Beruna. Lucy longed, as she had always done, to take Reepicheep up in her arms and cuddle him. But this, as she well knew, was a pleasure she could never have. It would have offended him deeply. Instead, she went down on one knee to talk to him. Reepicheep put forward his left leg, drew back his right, bowed, kissed her hand, straightened himself, twirled his whiskers, and said, in his shrill, piping voice,
"My humble duty to your Majesty, and to King Edmund, too."
Here he bowed again.
"Nothing except your Majesty's presence was lacking to this glorious venture."
"Ugh! Take it away!" wailed Eustace. "I hate mice, and I never could bear performing animals. They're silly and vulgar and sentimental."
"Am I to understand,"
said Reepicheep to Lucy after a long stare at Eustace,
"that this singularly discourteous person is under your Majesty's protection? Because, if not..."
At this moment Lucy and Edmund both sneezed.
"What a fool I am to keep you all standing here in your wet things," said Caspian. "Come on below and get changed. I'll give you my cabin, of course, Lucy, but I'm afraid we have no women's clothes on board. You'll have to make do with some of mine. Lead the way, Reepicheep, like a good fellow."
"To the convenience of a lady," said Reepicheep. "Even a question of honour must give way, at least for the moment."
And here he looked very hard at Eustace. But Caspian hustled them on, and in a few minutes Lucy found herself passing through the door into the stern cabin. She fell in love with it at once. The three square windows that looked out on the blue, swirling water astern, the low-cushioned benches round three sides of the table, the swinging silver lamp overhead. Dwarf's work, she knew at once, by its exquisite delicacy. And the flat, gold image of Aslan the lion on the forward wall above the door. All this she took in a flash, for Caspian immediately opened a door on the starboard side and said,
"This'll be your room, Lucy. I'll just get some dry things for myself."
He was rummaging in one of the lockers while he spoke.
"And then leave you to change. If you'll fling your wet things outside the door, I'll get them taken to the galley to be dried."
Lucy found herself as much at home as if she'd been in Caspian's cabin for weeks, and the motion of the ship did not worry her. For in the old days, when she had been a queen in Narnia, she had done a good deal of voyaging. The cabin was very tiny, but bright with painted panels, all birds and beasts and crimson dragons and vines, and spotlessly clean. Caspian's clothes were too big for her, but she could manage. His shoes, sandals, and sea boots were hopelessly big, but she did not mind going barefoot on board ship. When she had finished dressing, she looked out of her window at the water rushing past and took a long, deep breath. She felt quite sure they were in for a lovely time.